Symphony, presenting International Mosaic, Saturday evening, March 6th at the Kemper Center, featuring Bartok, Grieg, and more. Watch the live stream on the Symphony's YouTube channel or buy tickets for the socially distanced performance at KenoshaSymphony.org.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconsard, and this is Education Matters. Today, we have two special guests on the program to discuss college costs and how to afford them, and ultimately, the value of a college education. The first guest is Ron Lieber, who is the author of the new book, The Price You Pay for College, an entirely new roadmap for the biggest decision your family will ever make, who is himself a graduate of Amherst College in Massachusetts. Mr. Lieber is the financial columnist for the New York Times, writing the Your Money column since 2008. He is the author of 5 books related to personal finance and has a special interest in college costs because he is also the father of 2 daughters. Welcome, Ron.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Our second guest is Dr. John Swallow, who is the 23rd president of Carthage College. He came to Carthage in 2017 from the University of the South in Sewanee, Tennessee. He also earned his college degree from Sewanee, graduating at the age of 19 with 2 majors, and went on to earn 2 master's degrees and a PhD from Yale University, and then came to Carthage by way of Davidson College in North Carolina and Sewanee on his way to his ultimate destination, Kenosha, Wisconsin. Welcome, Dr. Swallow.
Thank you. It's great to be on your show. Thanks for having this show. I enjoy it.
Well, this is my first interview with a New York Times columnist. I will tell you that right now. So it is nice to see both of you. I just want to remind listeners that we are taping this show from our homes and workplaces rather than the WGTD studio, and therefore our sound quality may waver a bit. And in my case, we may be invaded by one of my cats. So please bear with us. I also want to fully disclose that I'm a professor at Carthage College, so Dr. Swallow is my boss. And I have a 16-year-old son who will be making his college visits this summer, so I need Mr. Lieber's advice just as much as the rest of the listeners. So Dr. Swallow is here for only the first half of this interview, so I'm just going to dive into the parts of the book that might be of interest to a small college president first, and then in the second half of the interview, I will ask Mr. Lieber some questions from my point of view as a parent to help all of the parents who may be listening. So first I want to say, Mr. Lieber, the subtitle of your new book is An Entirely New Roadmap for the Biggest Financial Decision Your Family Will Ever Make. There are a lot of books out there about college costs. In fact, you review many of them within your book. So what is, quote, entirely new about your book?
Part of the reason I wrote The Price You Pay for College is because I did not feel like parents had enough of a granular sense of who pays what and why, how the system works, how the merit aid discounting system branched off from the need-based financial aid system that I experienced as an undergraduate 30 years ago and became an entirely separate track that is not always as clear or as transparent as it could be. I also felt like most of the books on this topic were a little bit bloodless. They did not have enough emotional intelligence, and they did not encourage parents to be emotionally honest with themselves about the fear, the guilt, the snobbery, and the elitism, among other unhelpful feelings that can invade and pervade in this process. And I didn't feel like there were enough books that really talked pointedly about value and suggested any number of questions that undergraduates or high school students and their families might ask in order to get a better sense of who was actually delivering whatever it is that they thought they were looking for, among other reasons.
Okay. Well, I will have to say from having read the book that it is full of questions for people to ask on campuses. And we're going to get to ask some of those of Dr. Swallow in a little bit. So one of the things that happens throughout the book is you weigh the costs versus benefits of various college options. And again, you seem to come up on the value side for many small colleges like Carthage. So I'm going to allow Dr. Swallow to make his small liberal arts college pitch and then allow Mr. Lieber to confirm or deny the value of this kind of education on the various dimensions that Dr. Swallow describes. So Dr. Swallow, go ahead. Tell us about why people should come to a small college.
Oh, I'm happy to. So for me, it starts with the relationship between faculty members and students. And then I would broaden that out to the relationship between students and students and staff and students. That can happen at a human scale. That can happen in a way that each knows the other. And that allows great learning to happen. So yes, it happens in smaller classes rather than classes of hundreds of students, but it also happens in office hours. It happens in the fact that a person like a faculty member can know their students as people, not just as the students in the classroom. That really is the deep idea of a residential liberal arts college, where you have a community. So it is a learning community of faculty, staff, and students, but one where you know each other as individuals. And so for to take the opposite view, if to take a high school and then make it 10 times as big, I think we all know that the bureaucracy that tends to happen and the over-specialization that can sometimes occur at places like that really hold back that intimate relationship. Now, I'm not saying that at a big place you can't make friends and you can't find a small group, but I think for many students, and I count myself among them and my children among them, that was not the ideal environment for the learning that we wanted to happen over 4 years, but between the ages of 18 and 22. So it's for me, it's providing lots of opportunities for talented students, yes, but it's also doing it in a human scale and an environment where as many people as possible get to know each other and form a community.
Okay, so I'm going to sum that up as being sort of the human scale and relationships, even though there were some other things included in there. So I'm going to ask Mr. Lieber then to respond to that and tell us, you know, what your research found on this topic.
Sure. So I guess here's how I would put it. And I'm not neutral as a product of a small liberal arts college myself. It's hard for me to be neutral on the matter, but I would encourage families to begin by defining what college means to them. And there is no right answer to this question. But when I did my Lapse of America, you know, asking families how they felt about it, I heard three responses, basically. College is about the learning. It is about having your mind grown and your mind blown. It is about having your brain stripped bare and reassembled by an expert practitioner in the classroom and outside as well. That's number one. Number two, college is about kinship. It is about the friends that you make along the way and the grownups you encounter, whether they are faculty members or deans of financial aid or presidents, if you can actually meet them, you know, at the institution that you're attending. I worked at the president's house at Amherst. I assisted the chef in the kitchen, and I was a waiter at state occasions at his house. It's one of the best jobs I've ever had, right? And I got to know President Pouncey. So that's number two, kinship. Number three, it's about the credential. It's about gaining a degree that means something to someone afterwards, whether it's someone on a graduate school admissions committee or a fellowship operation, or obviously in the entry-level marketplace and beyond. And so, I don't really care what you value as a parent. I make no judgments about that. I cast no aspersions. And it is possible that, you know, yours may be a family that cares only about the credential, doesn't care much about the learning, and doesn't care much about the kinship. And credentials from big, large brand name institutions will often, in some instances, not every, carry more weight in the marketplace than a degree from a small liberal arts college in the Midwest. And that's not right, but it is so. And if that's the only thing that's important to you, then, you know, by all means, go to Syracuse and never meet your professors.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it. Another thing that comes up over and over in your book, Mr. Lieber, is the term merit aid. How do you define that? And then once you have defined it, I'll ask Dr. Swallow about Carthage's new approach to this practice.
Oh my goodness, where to start? So merit aid means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. You know, at its core, or at least at its origins, the big idea with merit aid was that the most accomplished slice of an applicant pool would be offered a discount that had nothing to do with their financial need, and it was based entirely off their prowess and promise, as measured by their GPA, their test scores, and their leadership abilities. But let's be real about what was really going on here, right? When Ohio Wesleyan started throwing money around in the 90s, it was because it wanted to buy students away from Denison and buy prestige away from Denison. And it wanted, you know, people to stop thinking of Ohio Wesleyan as like a lowly place for partying losers, right? And it worked. Right? You start throwing money at teenagers and people respond. But then, you know, if you're Denison, right, you don't want your students being bought away by Ohio Wesleyan. So you've got to respond competitively. And then Kenyon has to get in the mix because Denison's offering, you know, the money. And then Oberlin has to follow Kenyon. And pretty soon everybody in Ohio is doing it and it spills over. And, you know, flash forward to 2021 and all but the, let's call it 50 most selective colleges and universities in America, public and private now, offer some form of merit aid. And as you go farther and farther down the food chain, all of a sudden, before too long, you get to these private institutions in particular where everybody gets a trophy. And so it's no longer merit aid. It's just about leverage and discounting and couponing. It's not coming from the endowment. It's not a scholarship. It's just a form of offering a discount. So for families, it can be hard, if not impossible, to figure out exactly what kind of institution you're dealing with. And I have a problem with that.
Okay. So Carthage was kind of part of that game that you're talking about for a while, maybe, if I'm remembering it correctly. But just last fall in 2019, or I guess that's a year ago fall, Carthage just tried a new approach. And I'm going to allow Dr. Swallow to discuss that approach and then sort of the early results of it so far.
Sure. Well, so Ron, I absolutely agree that the system is so complicated and it's so opaque to many parents. And I'd say that opaqueness depends in part on what their background is with the education system, whether parents went to college, and then what college was like when they went. And so there's a lot of misunderstanding, and maybe that's not even the right word. It's deliberate confusion, if we want to say that, on the part of the whole system. There are families that don't know that they're eligible for Pell Grants. There are families, and we encountered this in our research, many, many families did not know that there was discounting at all. Okay, so you look at that and you look at an all-in price of $60,000, and I can guarantee you there are lots of families in middle-class neighborhoods that simply say, I mean, that they would laugh if somebody in their neighborhood said, my daughter's considering Carthage. Because they'd say that's absolutely impossible, or you're going to be in debt for the rest of your life for that to happen. Even though, in our case, we had been giving more financial aid for over 10 years. The average family is paying less recently than the average family did 10 years before, and that's not after adjusting for inflation. So our view, and you know that there are some schools that have considered this, was to say that list price is sending the wrong signal in the marketplace. There are a lot of families that can't afford and would be great matches for Carthage, but they're not seeing us because of what we are showing. And we had gone down that road, put the price very high, and then offer large scholarships and make people feel great, which is great. I love that. I'm not against making people feel great. Nothing wrong with that. But that meant that there were a lot of people not in the applicant pool. And so 2 years ago, we lowered our tuition 30%. And now we did that in September of 2019. That was in the middle of our application cycle because we tend to start kind of early. But for fall of 2020, we saw a 6% increase in our enrollment in the fall. And then we're seeing another 9 to 10% increase in net deposits this year. Can I attribute it all to the tuition reset? Well, no, because as you know, these are very complicated systems and a lot of things are happening at once, including COVID and protocols around COVID. But I would say that many more families are considering Carthage and able to get to the end of having us on their short list and then making a decision. And that wouldn't have been the case if we had just continued on a path that would mean that one day our all-in price would be over $100,000, which is just patently ridiculous.
So that's sort of interesting. I know when Carthage first made this announcement, everyone was sort of scrambling to find out where has this been done before and was it successful and what's the long-term prospect. So I wonder if you can tell us, Mr. Lieber, what your research has turned up.
People are somewhat skeptical about the medium to long-term effect of what's known as a, you know, sort of tuition reset. I know the President Swallow is aware of this. I'm sure your consultants filled you in. And, you know, there's at least one expert out there, one study that's been done of, you know, everybody that's done this in the last 20 years, and that gets passed around, you know, in the boardroom anytime this is considered. But I have no beef with the notion that a price tag of a list price of $100,000 being patently ridiculous. We're headed there. The University of Chicago is over $80,000 now. You know, it'll be there by the time my 5-year-old goes to college. You know, University of Chicago is its own case. It's its own unique institution. I don't know that I would pay $100,000 to send my kid there, but for the right kid, you know, it might be worth that. So I'm all for experimentation. But I guess the question that I would ask is, you know, is a tuition reset a sort of nibbling around the edges if there's still a lot of lack of clarity on the front end about what people will actually pay at the end? So, you know, the question I always want to ask, and while I didn't get into Dr. Swallow's office as I was running around in America, the, you know, thing that I would literally pound the table on if I got exercised enough is, what are you doing to provide more predictability at the front end about what sort of merit aid someone might be offered? Like, you know, it doesn't seem right that we should be asked to put our name in for an application without knowing, you know, even within $100,000, what the price tag might be at the end.
Right. No, I absolutely agree. And I think that was the notion of the net price calculator to try to give families an early indicator. We've tried to send our financial aid packages out as soon as we can after admission, and we have rolling admissions. So we don't have all these deadlines that wait. So it's not like send us your tax form and your transcript and 9 months later we'll get back to you, which right. You know, I think was the old way of doing things. So we're much more responsive to families because actually we think it is in their interest and our interest to be in conversation with us for a whole year, not to check in at one point and then months later get another communication that yes, you're accepted. We would like to have them react to the financial aid package, even as they hear it from other schools. And because we think they're going to learn more about us and we're going to learn more about them, and they can make the right decision that way. So I absolutely agree, Ron. It's kind of stunning what people were willing to put up with for so long.
Well, so this is the thing, right? I am trying to encourage people not to be supplicants in this process, and am frankly trying to raise an army of, you know, consumers that feel entitled to a fair bit more predictability on pricing and a lot more information about outcomes. Not because I mean to be oppositional about this, but because I just feel like at these prices, and given how important this process is, and how much of a fan I am of higher education generally, that we should just all be doing better. We should be better shoppers. You should be better sellers. And this whole thing ought to work differently and cause less stress and require less time, frankly. Like, I shouldn't have had to write this book. It's bad that this book is in the world. It's a bad thing. It's going to be useful, but the fact that it needed to exist means something's wrong.
Yes, well, I would agree there. So this is a good book in response to a increasingly complicated system. So if you look back from Pell Grants to federal loans to the FAFSA, at every moment, someone with good intentions makes something more complicated and has more choice architecture, you know, early decision, late decision, and all of that just makes it too complicated. I mean, I think if there's just a fundamental level, this is way too complicated. But somehow it hasn't been in the collective interest to simplify it. Each institution in their own group somehow thinks that more complexity there will give them some kind of advantage. which does not advantage families. So I'm glad you wrote your book, Ron. It's a good thing.
Thank you. I'm upset that it was. Oh, if enough of us beat the system, maybe we'll break it. And then we'll start over.
That's an interesting way of talking about it. You are listening to WGTV HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion with Mr. Ron Lieber about his newly published book, The Price You Pay for College, is archived at WGTV.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTV Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So I was going to ask this of both of you, but considering how much of your book is about college costs, what does the research say about whether college is actually worth it, regardless of where you go?
I mean, define worth.
Mm-hmm.
How are you defining worth, Karen?
Yeah, well, so I have a 16-year-old son. Defining worth for us, for him, is about finding, I think for him, it's about finding a profession that he feels comfortable doing and that he can support himself with. We don't have a lot of the other things that we know peers consider to be important. I don't know that we do. So he's looking at a huge range of different places.
Yeah, so if the big idea is to help him find something that will enable him to earn a living and make him incredibly happy for the rest of his life, that's a perfectly good framing, right? And not enough parents spend enough time during the college shopping process figuring out what sort of career services, counseling, and operation that a school has cooking. And it turns out that these schools are now onto us because more of us parents are asking more of these questions and more pointed ones about these offices. And the fact of the matter is that a generation ago, a lot of them really sucked. I mean, excuse my French, right? But this was a conversation I had with Clayton Spencer, the president of Bates College. She sort of laughed and she said, the better the institution, the worse the career services offices are. Because there was this like sort of blithe, waspy assumption that like everybody would be taken care of by the well-networked parents or whatever. And that's just not true. And it's not right. It doesn't deliver value. And so at Bates and at so many other institutions, they've just blown these offices to smithereens. I mean, literally, they've taken them apart brick by brick, built new buildings, put them in new places, busted up the office, hired three times as many new people. So in the end, to what end? That's not a rhetorical question you should be asking. If you have a really smart kid who's going to college and has no idea what he wants to do with his life, and notice I did not use the word but, right? It's not but he has no idea what he wants to do with his life. Who cares if he doesn't know? He's a teenager. He's not supposed to know. He should change his mind three times. But what are they doing at that place? What specific program and pathway do they have to entice an 18-year-old freshman into the career services office and help him figure out what would make him happiest? What is the program? You should feel entitled to go into the career services office. You shouldn't feel entitled to ask that question. You should get a rigorous, serious answer that involves 4 years worth of interaction. They should have a first destination study there in the career offices that they will hand you so that you can know that if he ends up being a Spanish major or religion major, that first destination survey will tell you, okay, what happened to the 8 Carthage Spanish majors last year? Where did they go? What did they do? How much do they earn, right? Are they employed at all? These are questions they should be able to answer for you. And if they can't or if they won't, take a walk.
Well, okay. Well, that's pretty clear. Because my next question was going to be, where should parents start their college search? So let's say you have an eighth grader. What should people be doing now if they have an eighth grader?
Well, I think the most important thing to do if you have an eighth grader actually doesn't have anything to do with the eighth grader at the front end, right? Because if if the two of you or one of you, if you're flying solo, or this is certainly a conversation you should have with an ex, and if there's step parents involved, it gets complicated, but their financial situations are now all intertwined. You know, there should be a big honking grown-up conversation about what it is that we think that we will be able to pay, what it is that we think we will be willing to pay or to borrow, right? Is there a gap or a gulf in between those two things? And if so, how are we going to explain this to our eighth grader? Because that eighth grader is entitled to an explanation. That eighth grader is entitled to know, going into high school, exactly what sort of financial options, if any, will be available. That eighth grader is not entitled to a parent borrowing $300,000, you know, to send the kid to Northwestern or Carleton College. That eighth grader is not entitled to go out of state to Ann Arbor and pay $55,000 a year. But the eighth grader is entitled to an explanation, to kind of know where things stand. These are not always easy conversations, and I don't intend to, you know, underestimate the difficulty of kind of opening your financial lives, your financial intentions to a 14-year-old, but it's sort of time, right? Mm-hmm. And the other thing that the eighth grader needs to know is that, you know, at all sorts of institutions that offer merit aid, a really good GPA and really good test scores will be worth discounts at ever better schools that may bring those schools into financial reach for your family. And again, right, we don't want to put too much pressure on them, but the alternative is not telling them how the system works until it's time to apply. And by that point, the vicious math of high school grade point averages is like not working in their favor. There's not much they can do to turn it around. So again, I just think we have to be real, even with the eighth graders.
And then for 10th graders, what would you be doing at this point? I know COVID has kind of truncated a lot of those plans, but
yeah, I mean, it's hard to do much wandering around even if you can afford to, but you know, most of these campuses are not closed entirely, and you can learn an awful lot just by walking around and reading the walls, right? Like, what's posted, right? What's being protested? What are people talking about? Who's being invited to campus? What are people saying to one another? You know, go look around, have a peek, sniff the air, right? Have a meal, sit in the center of the quad and watch the world go by and see how that feels. Go eavesdrop on conversations somewhere, and definitely, definitely read the campus newspaper. I can't believe that people don't do this. I was biased as a newspaper journalist, right? But you can learn a lot about the place even if it has a mediocre newspaper, about, you know, what the students care about, what they focus on, what people are arguing about, what's controversial, what and who is being celebrated and featured. So, you know, there's a lot you can do, even if you can't yet go and tour the way that you would like to.
Okay. So I have a feeling I know what the answer to this is, but what is the best source of information about college costs?
Well, where do you start? I guess my favorite source of information is something called the common data set that the vast majority of applicant families, I would argue 99%, never even see and may not have heard of. The common data set is a collection of data about the institution that contains anything and everything that a ranking organization like the U.S. News and World Report Guide would want to know. So it's just chock full of, you know, institutional data about, you know, GPA and SAT and where people come from and who's on the faculty and, you know, what race they are and who's paying what and how the financial aid data is laid out. And, you know, can take a little bit of studying to figure out exactly what the numbers mean, but once you have them, there's all sorts of windows there, you know, into affordability, into what sort of need-based aid and merit aid might be offered, who might be getting it, even if the school doesn't want to talk about it on their admissions or financial aid page. So, you know, I'd start there. You can learn a lot from the college scorecard, particularly around what people in different income bands are paying on average at these institutions. I would certainly fill out the net price calculator on every institution's website if money is going to be a factor. That allows you to predict with reasonable but not always complete accuracy what need-based financial aid you might be offered. And sometimes it offers some merit aid predictability too. So I'd start there.
Okay, and just listeners, I will make sure that the common data set and the college scorecard are in the show notes for this episode and also on the Facebook page, so you can find them. So if a family has three or more children, what's the best way for them to think about and manage college costs? I only have one, but I know a lot of families who have three or more. So,
well, ideally, even if you did not have them close together, they go to college close together so that there's some overlap. In general, at present, you get a better deal on financial aid if you have multiple kids in college at once. That may be changing vis-a-vis the federal formula. Private institutions may continue to do their own thing with their own institutional money. So what does that mean for the oldest kid? Well, maybe the oldest kid takes a gap year or two, right? Doesn't start college until they're 19 and 20 to create more overlap to allow for the possibility of more discounts. Other than that, you know, it's just that there needs to be a fair bit more realism about what it's going to take, both in terms of, you know, saving more and saving earlier, if it is at all possible in your budget. Having the kids work more and maybe work earlier, if that is possible. And you know, thinking about strategies like starting a community college, which is no shame. You know, they're incredible instructors at community college. And if you go in and, you know, you find just the right advisor, you know, you can get in and out in 2 years and, you know, be off to Madison or wherever you want to go, you know, without having paid a whole lot of money.
So that's good advice. And we have actually, I have lots of students who come from community colleges to Carthage, mm-hmm. and sometimes the match isn't perfect between what they've taken and what we require, but it's usually definitely, you know, an mm-hmm. advantage. So I'll just echo that. So is it true that saving for college might actually put you at a disadvantage when applying for financial aid?
Not really, and I wish that myth would go away. If anybody wants to look for like the long form answer to that question, I wrote a column trying to blow that myth up in the New York Times probably 3 or 4 years ago. You know, perhaps you can find it, put it in the show notes. But I interviewed a financial planner in Portland, Oregon, who's very good on this topic, named Ann Garcia. So if you just Google Ron Lieber Garcia financial aid, you'll find it. And here's the deal, right? The federal formula only wants a little bit more than 5% of your college savings each year to be contributed to the overall cost. That's the way it currently works. You know, private colleges in theory use the same formula, but, you know, let's be real. These financial aid formulas are not realistic in terms of the percentage of your take-home pay that they expect that you will devote to college costs each year. And so the reality is that like income is taxed way too high in these financial aid formulas, taxed by the colleges, and savings is taxed way too low, I would argue, right? And so you end up, you know, you end up, if you've got savings, spending more of your savings and spending less of your income. If you don't have savings, the college is still going to expect a lot of your income, but if you're not able to give them a lot of your income, then you're in a pickle. And that's how people end up borrowing more money than they should. So I've never talked to anybody who regretted having a large balance in their 529 account. It's just not a thing.
Okay. Just quickly, you're listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzer. This is Education Matters. We're discussing with Ron Lieber his newly published book, The Price You Pay for College. You can listen to this show again at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. So I asked about a family of three or more kids. Let's say that family has three really different children. One is a high flyer with multiple AP courses and high grades and test scores. One is a B student with maybe above average test scores, and one is a student who struggles with high school and is only interested in the social side of college. So how would you approach a college search with kids like that?
I mean, the search is very different for the different kids. And unfortunately, the burden is on the parent to, you know, captain the knowledge acquisition and the sort of stumbling around and then the, you know, sorting and touring, you know, for each of them. And the learning that you have with the first one isn't necessarily going to overlap all that much with the next two. You know, the beauty of the American system is that there are, in fact, thousands of choices. This is something we specialize in American consumerism, right? Everybody gets a lot of choice. There's a lot of price points, right? But when it comes to lighting a fuse, behind your child and launching them into the educational, you know, stratosphere, hopefully at like a really high angle, you know, a high trajectory, it means there are a bunch of different possibilities available to you. And if your kids are in three different places, it's almost like you're dealing with three different systems and certainly three different sets of schools. So, you know, you're sort of starting over with the learning and the research each and every time. I wish there was a better answer than that, but, you know, the alternative is to be, you know, some of these European universities where, you know, you're tracked at 4 and off to trade school at 14. And by 8, you don't really have any realistic chance of going to university. And, you know, it's probably not what we want here.
Yeah, I agree that there's something about the U.S. higher ed system that has like all kinds of second chances. I mean, I constantly meet adults who are kind of reinventing themselves by doing some sort of new degree or certificate program. So I guess that's a plus side.
Yep.
So as a parent, you very cleverly decided to research and write a book about a topic you needed to learn about anyway. This is a tried and true kind of thing in academia as well. So what are two new things that you learned in the process of reading and writing this book that you're probably going to apply for your own daughters?
Oh, that's such a great question. I guess I'll use that as an excuse to talk about the things that I'm really excited to do. And what I'm excited to do more than anything is just go see way more places, right? I want my kid to really think about, you know, urban versus suburban versus small town versus rural. I want her to think about north versus south. I want her to think about east versus west. I want her to think about like whether she would want to take a shot at, you know, earning a full ride at some of the institutions that offer that. You know, when it comes to merit aid, you know, she seems to be a good enough student that she might have a shot, right? So it's like, you can go do that, go to college for free, instead of, you know, taking all of our money and you know, going someplace, you know, a school that's much more selective that doesn't offer merit aid. You know, that might be an interesting choice to have in front of her. I want to go see the work colleges, which I didn't get to in my reporting. And I want to go see them now. You know, I mean, maybe she'll go to College of the Ozarks and, you know, work 20 hours a week and scrub toilets and get a huge discount and meet an incredible variety of people from all over the country. And, you know, this is a privilege, right? In order to see a lot of places, you need a lot of time, and you need at least a medium amount of money, you know, to go wandering around and doing that. Not everybody can do that. I can understand that. But, you know, with creative web searching, you can learn a lot about a lot of places. So what's the advantage to this? Well, the advantage to applying a lot of places is that you may have some, you know, unexpected outline discount bids available to you. And if you want to take a shot at one of those full ride schools, there's a family that I wrote about in The Price You Pay for College where the daughter applied to over 30 schools. And the goal was, I want to get a full tuition ride at the very best school that I possibly can that offers such a thing that is of interest to me. And for her, it was Tulane, and she got it. But the family knew enough to know that the odds of getting those full scholarships at anywhere that they're offered is lower than the odds are of getting into Stanford in most instances. So you gotta buy a lot of lottery tickets, you know, if that's your goal. So, you know, we're going to go do a lot of stuff and see a lot of stuff. And I can't wait to see how she ends up feeling about this. You know, I could try to predict it, but it's just going to be fun to watch. Mm-hmm.
Your final chapter is entitled One More Feeling, Hope. And I actually thought the whole thing about feelings was really an important part of your book, because I had a lot of feelings while I was listening to it. And a lot of them were, I was surprised because I thought I knew a lot about this and I really didn't. But I'm interested in this hope part of it. So what is your final wisdom that might help parents feel hopeful about their child's college search, college cost, and college experience?
So first of all, thank you, because that's the highest compliment that someone could pay for, someone could pay me, that someone in the academy says, I thought I knew a lot about this and I really didn't. So thank you for saying that. I feel hope because residential undergraduate institutions are by their nature hopeful places, right? Anything is possible. There are all of these young people imbued with promise and energy. At the smaller ones in particular, there are a whole bunch of grownups around like you who do nothing and care nothing except about helping teenagers and people in their early 20s rearrange their brains and find themselves in the world. That's an incredible privilege to have that opportunity. Who would feel anything but hope walking around a place like that and imagining their kid there? Plus, the other thing that filled me with hope, and that was a learning for me that wasn't surprising, but you know, was an opportunity through reporting to see it for myself. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of places where my 15-year-old would grow and thrive and excel and have an opportunity to do anything or everything in the world that she chooses to. And I am going to try my level best not to get hung up on whether she goes where I went or whether she goes where her mom went or whether she goes, you know, to whatever fancy places some of her friends might go. You know, I want her to go, you know, to the place where she can make the music that only she can make.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Thanks to my guest today, Ron Lieber, the Your Money columnist for the New York Times and author of the new book, The Price You Pay for College, and Dr. John Swallow, president of Carthage College in Kenosha. You're listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion with Mr. Lieber about his new book is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You're invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. Thank you very much.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. The staff at Piasecki Funeral Home can help you plan a meaningful funeral or memorial service. They consider it an honor to serve families in their community since 1931. KenoshaFuneralHome.com.
Support for WGTD comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management, a career for people, planet, and profit from UW-Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. Details at uwp.edu.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Kenosha Community Foundation is now accepting applications for 2021 grants. Deadline for applications is Thursday, March 25th. Visit www.kenoshafoundation.org. Support comes from Kenosha County ADRC. Kenosha County Western Transit now offers Saturday and Sunday demand service from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Fares are $5 one way for the general public and $3 for older adults or persons with disabilities. For reservations, call 888-203-3498.
This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, Laura Sumner Kuhn, a former journalist with the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW-Parkside, and Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Good morning. This is Len Iaquinta for Community Matters, and our topic today is a report from the cities in our Signal area, the major cities of Kenosha, Racine, and Elkhorn. And we'll be speaking with the mayor, John Antaramian of Kenosha, and then Corey Mason, the mayor of Racine, and the city administrator of Elkhorn, James Heilman. We're pre-recording this program on January 20th. Good morning, Kenosha Mayor John Antaramian.
Good morning, Len.
I'd like to start, Mayor Antaramian, by asking you, what's the outlook for the city of Kenosha in terms of your budget, your revenue from various sources, and your expenses for the current year, 2021, and what your thinking is about the outlook for the coming year, because we often see time lags in the effect on municipal budgets after a recession like we've experienced.
Well, as we look at last year's budget and what occurred, the city took precautions immediately with what was going on because of COVID. And because of that, we reduced a lot of programs and projects that we're working on and doing to reduce the overall costs, because literally we were shutting down a lot of the summer activities, actually shut down most of the summer activities. So we did the things we needed to do to preserve capital, made sure that we ran the programs that we needed to run and make sure those were available to the public, making sure that safety and other types of activities.